I can't call the meeting to order because people are running late. So we don't have a quorum. So anyhow, we will get started today with House File 423, Representative Brand's bill. It's an informational hearing only to begin with because it's technically still in the Division of Early Childhood Finance and Policy Division. The funny thing is a lot of bills seem to be in finance committees that are going to get financed out of this committee that aren't here yet. So I'm not sure how that's all working. But I'm sure with the brilliance that we have in this particular building, we'll figure it out. So if Representative Brand, could you please step to the testifiers table?
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. It seems as we don't have to move your bill, we're not, but I would ask you to get started, bring up your testifiers, and let's hear about $13 million worth of construction in greater Minnesota.
You bet. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for hearing at least informationally the bills, House File 422 and 423 this morning. This is going to be something that will help in greater Minnesota where there is a child care crisis right now. The first bill, House File 422, would provide $3 million in general fund for grants to the Minnesota Initiative Foundations, the MIFs that are across our state that understand and know what's going on in child care right now and are helping to do something about it. Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, for instance, is representative of where I come from. And right now, for instance, they're working on child care issues in the cities of Eagle Lake, Wells, Minnesota. Those are cities that are having, sharp declines in child care opportunities for a growing number of folks that are trying to do their jobs at work. And we know that if folks are strapped to the situation where they can't find child care, they quit their jobs and they take care of their children, plain and simple. And this is a missed opportunity for economic development in greater Minnesota, I believe. And then the second bill, House File 423, this would provide $10 million for a capital grants program to build new child care facilities across our state. That would be administered to the deed division. And what it would do is it would provide up to a maximum of $500,000 to build facilities across our state for the purposes of offering new slots for child care so we can get people back to work. It's as simple as that. And so this morning I've got a list of testifiers that wish to talk a little bit about the child care crisis in greater Minnesota and also touch on this program. But what I will note personally is that in 2013, when I was a city council member in St. Peter, myself and another city council member were having a very small conversation about child care. We both had newborn kids, and we're having a hard time trying to find opportunities for child care in St. Peter. And it just so happened that our city administrator, Todd Prafke, was listening at the time, and he said, tell me more. And from that created a community study. We brought a whole host of shareholders to the table, industry, schools, county, city, a whole host of different people. And from that study, it was determined that we needed to invest in our community for child care. And so we spent some money through our EDA to bring a daycare center to St. Peter. And then we also spent some money to provide opportunities for folks who wanted to do in-home daycares to have the certification training program and then also to get their homes ready for child care. And basically, House File 422 and 423 are a macro version of what we did at the micro level in St. Peter. And that's all I have for now, but I wanted to bring down some testifiers. Maybe we could start first with Nan Dorman with the Greater Minnesota Partnership.
It's always nice to see a former colleague.
Glad you feel that way, Mr. Chair. I feel the same way.
Good morning. Always good to keep the wits awake this early in the morning,
that's
Mr.
Right.
Dorman. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the executive director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. The partnership represents about 500 different entities across Greater Minnesota, from businesses, chambers of commerce, some of our higher ed folks, some of our nonprofits, and we work on primarily economic development issues. So last year, our board started looking at, and I should say that our sister organization, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, would tell you the same thing that I'm about to say, is that increasingly our members and the coalition members have recognized that economic development is being hindered in Greater Minnesota due to not the affordability necessarily of child care, which I think is a much bigger issue here in the metropolitan area, but actually just the availability of it, just being able to have it. Mm-hmm. Representative Brand referenced one of the mayor in St. Peter. We talk about the mayor in Little Falls. He was told, yeah, I'm going to take this job. We've got child care. Don't worry. Until he got there, had to scramble and try to find something and made something work, but not officially, until you could actually find that access. So in many of our communities, it isn't an affordability issue as much as it is an access issue. There's just no one there providing the service at any price. And so as we started to look at it and thought, well, how could that be? And one of the letters that you'll find in support of this legislation is from the Hormel Corporation in Austin. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at doing something. Austin responding to their manufacturing base, what do we do? But part of their problem, and I realize, Mr. Chair, you can't fix it in this committee, not asking you to, I'm just highlighting it. But if you look at something as simple as the CCAP reimbursement rate, and I live in Albert Lea, 20 miles from Austin. There really isn't a cost difference in those two towns. Yet in Austin, the CCAP rate is 10% less than it is in Albert Lea. And if you just go down 90 a little bit further to Stuartville, so you're crossing into Olmsted County, all of a sudden it jumps up to be a 50% increase in that CCAP rate. It makes it very difficult to not only staff these facilities, but almost impossible to afford any debt service. So both these bills, they sort of are trying to build a capacity in Greater Minnesota that we don't have. Training, and the training is critically important, but you also have to have somewhere where this activity can occur. And so in this case, it would be in grants that go out to the community. The way we envision it would be matched likely out of the business community to expand capacity, whether that is underutilized church space. There's a lot of that in Greater Minnesota that people are looking at. People are partnering with their schools trying to find something, or a child care center that wants to expand. They think they might be able to find the staff, but they sure can't find the staff that can afford a debt service payment. And so I understand that a little different issue in the metropolitan area. I get it, but we're sort of all in this together, and we hope this is the year that some of these issues are addressed. That's my testimony, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Well, you'll be around for a while, correct? Right. Oh, Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I do understand that affordability and accessibility of early learning institution is a problem. It's probably not just a problem in the rural community. Affordability and accessibility is a problem around the state, and definitely the reimbursement rate is something that we're trying to tackle within this body this year. But you said no one is providing child care services. Can you talk a little bit more about why they are not providing the services? I mean, is there a lack of those who are educated in the field? What's the barriers?
Mr. Norman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moran, it varies, but I'm going to give you some general impressions. The chair, when we met earlier, had asked about the difference in cost. I think that's certainly part of it. To answer your question, Mr. Chair, you asked us in your office about a 20% difference. In general, that's going to vary a little bit, so that's part of it. But in part, that's being driven by the CCAP rate. The state statute says that you cannot charge a CCAP parent a different rate than anyone else. Yet in a community like Austin, they're saying, wait a second, we'd like to charge two rates because we think that there are people that could afford to pay more in our community, but it gets set at the CCAP rate. And so I think that's part of what's keeping our rates a little artificially low, which I think then goes into that CCAP reimbursement rate. But if you think about Olmsted County versus Maurer County, they're right next to each other, $100 a week a kid, you get a debt service payment really quickly, even if you have five or six CCAP kids. So it's an important, and again, I realize I'm the wrong committee for that, But our problem is, again, is that access. If you call the Overly Community Child Care Center and you say, hey, I'm you know, looking for care for a toddler or for an infant, they're going to say, I hope you're not pregnant yet. That's how long the waiting list is in Albert Lea to try to get that infant cared for. And that was the same thing that Mr. Rademacher faced in Little Falls. So it's we don't have the you know, there's an economic privilege or just being part of a larger group. I think you'll find this issue is of availability is different in larger communities than it is in communities, say, 25,000 or under. Then when you get down to, like, Laverne sits in the south. Western corner of the state. It's in Rock County. It's the county seat. And if you look at their reimbursement rate for a 4-star CCAP, problem is in a center, they don't have one. The nearest one's in Worthington. It's just the lack of providers out there. And there's a whole lot of reasons for it, except for what we do know is that it's impeding economic development and growth.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Yep. So a lot what you just stated is that's universal, right? Like in a district like mine, the waiting list is huge. We just in the reimbursement rate, you know, we have daycare providers who say, you know, I can't really take a CCAP child because the reimbursement rate is just so low. This is a business for me, and I just can't do it. And, again, we are trying to address the reimbursement rate at the 75 percentile, so hopefully that would happen this year. But I'm still a little bit struggling about, you know, putting the CCAPs in the waiting list aside, which is universal across the state. How you may build a capacity for those individuals to say this is something I want to do that they're not doing now, right? Whether that's in a church or in someone's home, mm-hmm. you know, what would mean, because those are universal issues, right, around reimbursement, waiting lists. We just don't have enough providers based on the need, which is huge, which is great, you know, but still we have lack of providers mm-hmm. out state, and you know, where do you find them? The provider,
Representative Brand.
Yeah, maybe I can take a step. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moran. What I would say is this: in the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation, I've talked to CEO Tim Penny, former congressman, and he's, you know, they're trying to find folks. They're really trying to recruit folks. And I think the Minnesota Initiative Foundations are a great start for this because they can direct folks in the right direction when it comes to planning and building a business model that can work in the environment in which child care exists right now. I mean, we'll face it, it's highly regulatory on purpose, right, because of safety concerns. But maybe overly so, and that's something that our body should address, the legislature should address as well. The other thing I will say is it's very low when it comes to the amount of money that they make for profit because there's a lot of cost because of some of those regulations, again. And so we're trying to find folks who are interested in doing that. I can tell you that the initiative foundations are doing a very good job of finding folks who are interested. And once they're interested, then it's planning, then it's partnering them with folks like First Children's Finance or other opportunities through the grant process and different things that the state's doing to get them where they need to go. And these two bills specifically will help with that, especially when we talk about the training, because there's upfront costs associated with becoming licensed in the state of Minnesota. Those are sometimes a barrier. We found in St. Peter that those were a barrier to creating new opportunities for folks. And so this would address that specifically. Also, each individual's home is different, and some of these homes need a little bit of help to get them to a safe spot for these children to be, you know, in a good environment to grow and learn. And so in that way, that's also a barrier. This particular bill, the $3 million, addresses that as well through the MIFs.
Okay. I think the chair is going to have a comment here. You know, Representative Moran kind of hit on it. The same that affects greater Minnesota affects urban Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
I know a number of people who are looking for childcare, and they can't find them here in town. They can't find them apparently out in Greater Minnesota. This is my kind of my personal peeve, and maybe I shouldn't do it, but I have heard regulation, regulation, regulation. Everybody hates these regulations. I have not seen one legislator step up to the plate and put up a list of regulations they want to get rid of on child care. So either put up or shut up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm tired of hearing about it.
Yeah.
Hopefully, we come to some conclusion on how we move forward. I believe child care is a business, is a viable business. It's sustained for many years. People blame government reimbursement, but yet a certain group of people claim government shouldn't be involved in anything. You can't have it both ways. If you want your towns to thrive, we need to find a solution and a way to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have not, you guys are late to the table. I've been hearing about child care for jobs and economic development for the last 15 years. And now all of a sudden we're going to subsidize in Greater Minnesota alone how to build and remodel homes for child care? That seems like a pretty socialist way to go. Maybe I should have driven slower to work today. I'm going to go with Representative Gunter, and then I'll give you a minute, then we're going to move on to the next witness or testifier.
Mr. Chairman, I can't agree with you more. There's a lack of child care, metro versus Greater Minnesota. The degree in which there is a deal, in Greater Minnesota there's 35,000 to 36,000 slots, in the metro it's 6,000 to 7,000 slots. Either way, if it was two slots, that would be too much if we were short. I think the cost, Representative Moran, you hit it right on the nose. The cost in the metro area is about $15,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Cost in Greater Minnesota is about $9,000. And we have mostly, you have centers, we have mostly home daycare where we live. There's differences between the two places. Economic development-wise, AGCO in Jackson, which you're very well aware of, Mr. Chairman, is planning on doing something new in Jackson every 2 years. They are not planning something this 2 years because it's due this year because of lack of daycare. It's just that simple. If there's not a good daycare, and I stress good daycare, we're lost. And I agree, they've been 15 years.
Mr. Dorman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be very brief, and Representative Gunther touched on it, but one of the other issues is in Greater Minnesota, it's an inverse of in-home care versus centers, mm-hmm. and over that same 15-year period, or actually about 10 years, we've actually lost about 15,000 in-home providers and have not been able to replace them with centers because we just don't have the synergy that would allow, there's not that many for-profit centers. Most of ours are nonprofits, particularly in smaller communities. But is that for whatever reason, and Mr. Chair, I actually agree with a lot of your comments on regulation. I think it's lack of funding or, mm-hmm. If you make $9 an hour and somebody hands you a regulation, it seems like it's the regulation, but it really isn't. I get that. But it's that inverse is killing us, particularly as people are exiting that in-home setting. And I think part of that is, frankly, we don't treat them like business people often. They are. I'm shutting up. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Mr. Dorman. Next on, I've got three other testifiers here.
Yep.
You've got Nancy Joyce, Jose, Scott Marquardt, and Holly Sevier. Would you care to call one of them up?
Yeah, Nancy Joyce, why don't you come up and testify.
Good morning, Chair, representatives. I am Nancy Jost. I work for West Central Initiative, which is one of the six Minnesota Initiative Foundations, and I am the director of early childhood there. And if I could just speak to Representative Moran's question, if that would be all right. I have been in the early childhood for over 40 years, and I think we have a very complex issue that one thing isn't going to solve our problem. One of the things that always comes up are regulations, and I agree with Dan that if you make minimum wage and you have lots of regulations, you might say regulations are the problem. But really, until we can pay, and women are the ones who are, I think 99% of the population of child care providers are women. And so until we can figure out a way to pay women a worthy wage, we are going to have this issue. In West Central Initiative, one of the things we've done to help recruit and retain providers is we just hired a child care supporter because we were hearing from providers that they wanted some support with paperwork, with regulations, with child behaviors, those sorts of things. And so we're doing that. We're also surveying child care providers and other early childhood professionals when they leave the field to see why it is that they left. And we just started that in January, but so far it looks like a lot of it is retirement, some of it is health, and some are also moving to other from childcare to like Head Start or to a school district where they can make more money. And then some of it is also regulations. So just wanted to answer that before I started on my testimony. So every week
I'm gonna ask you to keep it a little bit briefer. We have about an hour and three more bills to do.
So every week we're contacted by people wanting to open a child care center in our region. And they're trying to figure out how to pay for a new building or renovate an existing one. There's just not enough money in our communities to raise what it usually takes is about $700,000. This state funding would be really helpful in solving the child care shortage. It would not be the only solution. The Minnesota Initiative Foundations are well situated to be the regional organizations to distribute the funding because we work closely with our communities, child care providers, Child Care Aware, and First Children's Finance. Because we work so closely with our communities, child care providers, Child Care Aware, and First Children's Finance, the MIFs, Minnesota Initiative Foundations, are also well situated to help communities find solutions to their child care shortage. We can provide technical assistance and training to potential and existing providers, and we can also help recruit providers to participate in Parent Aware. The MIFs are ready and willing to do what it takes to be a part of solving the child care shortage in rural Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Shall we just go down the line? Scott Marquardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Scott Marquardt. I work for Southwest Initiative Foundation. I manage our economic development programs. We serve 18 counties and two Native nations, basically cornered by Laverne, Jackson, Litchfield, Ortonville, part of Representative Gunther's district, and bordering South Dakota and Iowa. I am grateful that this conversation is happening in the Jobs Committee. This is the fastest growing economic development issue by far facing our region. I can say that on record. I fully agree 15 years or longer this has been happening. The fact that it's getting so much attention in St. Paul this year, we are grateful, sincerely, our board and staff. You've heard all the numbers. I won't bore you with the details. In our region alone, it's 3,100 slots that are short. I live in Chippewa County, 260 slots there. We can go on and on and on. It is significantly impacting our loan customers, our entrepreneurs, the companies in our region. We have a presence of Hormel in our region with Genio Turkey Store, businesses' ability to attract and retain talent, entrepreneurs wanting to come back from the high schools and the communities they graduated from to grow businesses, to grow families. Child care is impacting decisions. We've all heard broadband, housing, transportation. Yes, those are all still an issue, but child care has rocketed past them, in our opinion. I won't repeat what Dan and Representative Brand and Nancy have said, but you've trusted in us since 1986. The state of Minnesota has, as a partner, you funded us with loan capital, with entrepreneurship, investment appropriations, with other collaborations. We are confident we've delivered an ROI that we're very proud of and hopefully that you find of great value, and we look forward to you hopefully trusting in us with this bill again to go forward for another 33 years. We've helped create or retain over 49,000 jobs, especially with the funding that you've helped provide to us, and that's leveraged well over $1 billion. We know leverage is kind of a buzzword in this space, but the initiative foundations do leverage other dollars coming in. Many of us are either CDFIs or SBA microlenders. We work with community banks and other organizations to bring cash in. I think that would differentiate us and this investment that you're making, considering into the child care ecosystem. We don't operate in silos. It's not about us. It's not about the initiative foundations as sole players. As Nancy said, First Children's Finance, community banks, community colleges, the community action agencies. We have a pretty deep Rolodex. We don't do any of this stuff by ourselves. And if we'd be so fortunate to get this funding, we would engage and fully mobilize all of our partners to do the solutions. If I may address Representative Moran's question, this is the stuff that we're doing right now. We have one specific community near Representative Gunther's district where there's a church that has some space, wants to play in this space. There's an employer that wants to put some capital into it. There's a nursing home in the community that has a commercial kitchen, and there's a couple operators that could potentially come in and be the entrepreneur there. Our role is, frankly, matchmaking and bringing those parties together. I want to be very clear that all of the solutions to the child care crisis are local, even hyper-local. And if you've seen one solution, you've seen one solution. However, I think the value we would bring into this and continue to bring is the regional lens. For lessons learned, for best practices, for efficiencies, we can bring that and try to make that magic happen. The faith community, the K-12 community, they are stepping up now. A bigger concern of mine, frankly, not as much creating new slots, but frankly, retention. If you really want a visual, go to a child care provider appreciation event, have people stand up by how long they've been in the industry. The amount of people still standing in the 35 and 40-year club will hit you pretty hard. We talk about silver tsunami in manufacturing and ag biotech and retail and long-term care. Well, it's going to hit us harder in child care in rural, metro, anywhere in Minnesota. So how do we retain? How do we think about succession planning for these providers and mobilizing other solutions? If you notice, my comments are not about building more centers, building more family slots. It's community solutions and bringing people together. Creative use of a family license in a commercial space. We could go on and on. I think we have the Rolodex and the connections to be able to do that and to leverage the capital coming in. Yes, we are asking for $500,000 per region over a period of time. We can do a lot with that capital, leverage other federal dollars, leverage private philanthropy, and bring that in, hopefully, with the regional lens. I know you're short on time, but I just want to say when we do this stuff, we set an inclusive table. Again, with our Rolodex, we try to bring every voice to the table that matters. In my region is Worthington. According to American Community Survey data, it's the most diverse community per capita. So finding culturally appropriate and respectful, sustainable child care solutions are huge. And I think that's the word, Mr. Chair and members and Representative Brand, that I would close with is sustainable. This is not about throwing up more facilities and saying, yay, we created more slots. If they're not sustainable, if there's not a long-term plan for operations, game over. We've had centers open and closed within 7 months. Because of various reasons, X, Y, or Z, some regulatory, some financial, but we're not interested in solutions if they're not sustainable, and that's our MO and how we do it. So thank you for considering this, and we look forward to partnering with you.
Thank you, Mr. Marquardt. Holly Seville? Good morning. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Holly Sable, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Association of Child Care Professionals. I've been a licensed family child care provider in St. Michael for the past 14 years, and I'm here. Oh, and I also have my master's in early childhood, which I normally wouldn't need to say, but I am a quality provider. I'm here on behalf of MACCP to testify against House File 422, and is it okay if I'm also testifying against 423?
We're out of control already. You may have
all right. Let's go. Well, I appreciate some of the comments that members have already made. While we believe that these bills have good intentions, I want to stress and reiterate, as we have for the past several years, that money will not solve the child care crisis. This is not sustainable. It's not sustainable because of the environment we're in. The atmosphere is very much against family child care providers, which means against the families and children we serve, and it's affecting our economy. There's really simple solutions to it, and it doesn't involve throwing more money at it. Our profession has been low-paying, like, since the beginning of time. You can say that teachers aren't, you know, paid very much for the time they put in and what they do, but they do it because they love it. That is the reason we are family child care providers. And so I don't need more money to do what I love. We're losing providers who have been doing this for 10, 20, 30 years, and they're not quitting because I'm not making enough money now. And nothing has changed in 30 years, except the fact that we are being overregulated by completely asinine regulations. So I just want to note that, you know, I personally have not chosen to participate in Parent Aware. Our public policy director, Julie Seidel, however, has, but she is currently testifying in the Senate about some child care bills that do address overregulation, and we hope will resolve some of these issues. So I'm sorry that I'm not as good of a testifier as she would be on this subject. But she's been raided 3 times over the past 6 years. She's had to complete 141 pages of documentation, taken more trainings than her license requires, and complete observation forms, have parent-teacher conferences. Ironically, I do all those things anyways. But the design of the Parent Aware program has skewed the results. And so it's portraying family child care as a lower quality option. Parent Aware coaches are telling providers to rate low so that they can get these quality improvement grants. Go in at a 1-star because you get extra money, extra grant money at every level of the stars that you go through. But when you get to 4 stars, there's no incentive money. You don't get anything. So if you have the chance to get $2,500 or whatever it is at every star level, gosh, I wonder which one I'm going to go for. Parent Aware is inherently biased against government programs like school-based pre-K and Head Start, and more challenging for family child care than any other eligible program. School-based programs are automatically handed 4-star ratings. And then centers have the benefit of having many staff who get to fill out these mounds of paperwork and work on the observations. Family child care providers, we do it alone, and we do it proud. You know, you say that we're women-owned businesses, and we're not weak. I'm here. I took time off to be here. Sorry, I get emotional about it. Representative Moran mentioned that, or I think she was asking about the CCAP, mentioning the CCAP rate, and I do really want to clarify that, you know, as a provider who took families on CCAP, I can charge whatever rate I want. If the CCAP rate is not what my normal rate is, I have the choice as a small business owner to charge the difference between my normal rate and the CCAP rate. I did that. My families are happy to pay that because of the quality program I have. The unintended consequences of starting at a 1-star rating, as I mentioned, that many family child care providers do because of the financial incentive, is that your parents view you like a hotel star rating. Why would you go to a 1-star provider when you can go to a 4-star provider? However, there are many pathways to quality care, and Parent Aware is only one of them. And most providers who have chosen not to participate in Parent Aware are still quality providers, and insinuating anything otherwise is not fair. Please keep in mind that 70.8% of licensed family child care providers have stated that they have considered closing their doors. Of those, 92% have stated that the reason is overburdensome paperwork and regulations. You don't need a committee or a task force. Those are facts. Those are from a survey of thousands of family child care providers, thousands of them. Don't waste any more time trying to figure out the reason for the crisis. Please consider the repercussions for family child care and the children and families we serve, and please vote no on House File 422. As far as House File 423, I want to make it clear that family child care providers, we're limited in our license. We can have a maximum of 14 children in our care, and that's only if we have 2 licensed providers. Otherwise, you're limited to a maximum of 12. There's also a license for 10, 8, 6, and 7. The average, I think, is around 8.5 to 10 children. And so we can't throwing more money at it so we can, expand our homes. A lot of times we're limited on that, too. But it's not going to open up more slots. The loss of child care slots has been entirely in family child care. Yet House File 423 is going to be giving more money to centers. And in greater Minnesota, that's not necessarily sustainable either. Most families can't afford it. Family child care provides more accessibility and more culturally sensitive care. When a family has an emergency, we're able to say, you know what, that's okay, you could stay late. I've had families, they've been in accidents or there was a death in the family. And with a family child care provider, they can stay later, they can stay overnight, and that's the benefit of that. You can't do that in a center. And in greater Minnesota, those kinds of things happen. And so, I'm just asking that you please consider these things thoughtfully, that we're not asking for more money. That's not what it's about. We're just asking you to fix this very broken system. Thank you.
If I might ask, thank you. It is startling to hear sometimes the other side.
Thank you.
And I appreciate it because we don't always get it right here. I want that to be understood. And what I would ask is if your organization has, you heard me complain about people whining about regulations and never showing up, put one together. Send it off to us.
We have 16 bills, actually, Mr. Chair. We have 16 bills right now that have been introduced in the Senate and some of them that have been introduced in the House. That's what our public policy director, Julie Seidel, is testifying about, three of them in the House Early Childhood Finance Division Committee as we speak. And so, if you want to put up,
No, I will. I'll take a look at them.
Yes, please do, and let us know if you have any questions, because we want to keep children safe. We want to offer quality programs. We just want to have some common sense, regulations. We have one more piece of paper that's not going to keep children safe. You wouldn't believe some of the things that you hear about. I mean, I'm in it every day. I hear this every day. I know thousands of providers, and the things that people are complaining about, none of your homes, I'm sorry, would ever pass licensing regulations. None of the parents in our care, their homes would never be, licensed. And it's silly. I want to keep children safe, but let's do it through common sense regulation and reform.
So. Well, hopefully all the members here and all around the legislature will take a look at that. We have to balance a lot of things, but that might be one that we all have to look at.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Happy to hear it. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Moran?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To testify, I just want to say thank you for traveling here to testify and to bring your lived experience about what it takes and what's needed in greater Minnesota around child care. We've been talking about this for a long time. I mean, since I've been here, I worked in that field for like 15 years in many different sectors of early learning. That's what my degree is in, so it's really, really important to me, too. And even in a community like mine, where, the number of slots may be greater than rural Minnesota because we have more people, that impacts, the availability here in the urban core. But really some of the things that we've heard over the years about those home providers, which I agree, I like home providers because they're in the community, they're your neighbors, you know them, you trust them, opposed to, the big corporations and how they do their business. This is different. But some of the things that we've heard here is the regulations. It's to think small. It's being able to qualify for, whether you're a one rating or a four rating and why you got to be rated. I mean, those are the constant issues or concerns that we have heard over the years around providers deciding, or the reimbursement rates, deciding that, I can't do this. But those are the things that we require here at the state level, that says that if you want state dollars, we're going to do that based on your ratings. We're going to do that based on another piece of paper. We're going to do it based on regulations. But those are the barriers, you know, why we see providers saying, I'm not, I can't do this anymore. It's, you know, it's just not worth it, and I'm not making any money neither. And so, you know, I don't think we can really say buy our way out of this or pay ourselves out of, or throw more dollars into this, because it is, it's some other key factors that are the barriers to more providers or more individuals wanting to become providers in rural Minnesota. And so I haven't seen your bills. I would like to have some numbers of what's moving through this body to hear what's the foundation, what's the root of the issues, and how we can address those issues, and whether or not we can address those issues, because, you know, we do have regulations around dollars and what that needs to be. And, you know, a lot of that is having qualified individuals. We have to determine what qualified is and what that looks like. But that is also one of the biggest, one of the issues or concerns that we hear when it comes to providers. So if I'm wrong or out of step here, please respond and let me know. But there are some things, some underlying things that comes with state dollars that gets in the way of individuals being those home care providers who have just left it in huge numbers. And one being, you know, being licensing, having your home license. There, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work, right? I know that locally right here in my district what that looks like. And there's a cost associated with that to be up in at that standard of care. But, again, thank you so much for traveling here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, can I? Can I address Representative Moran's comments? If you,
right ahead.
I did. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate that, and it really is my pleasure to be here today to be able to, you know, shed some light on the crisis and provide a unique perspective. You know, unfortunately, with the being tied to state dollars, there's only in most of the statutes now in the past few years, like the early learning scholarships and extra CCAP rate have been tied entirely to the Parent Aware rating program, except for the CCAP rate, like because I had my master's in early childhood, I was able to get that 15% differential, which, you know, when you're, it, you know, like an extra couple bucks, really, it's not much. And that's okay because I'm not doing it for the money, and
we,
I can choose to
that.
Take families for, you know, any reason. But it's just the system is, it's kind of a, yep, this is the quality path, and here's the rest of you, and that's not reality. And some people just don't have the time to go through all of that again because we're doing this alone. But right now the system is just not fair. It's not a true reflection of quality because every stakeholder doesn't have the same opportunities and isn't rated in the same system, in the same way, you know. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Brand, do you have any final words?
Yes, I do. So, you know, I really appreciate the fact that everybody had a chance to kind of testify on this. I will say that, you know, it's a complex issue. It clearly is, and there's no simple solution to it. I think it's a multi-pronged, multi-year approach, frankly. And everybody up here is not wrong. Everybody up here is saying the truth, that it's a complex issue. It's not just a Greater Minnesota issue. It's an issue altogether. But what I will tell you is that in a place like Mankato, a small town of 50,000 people, I say small town tongue-in-cheek, but there's 863 slots that are missing. Those are opportunities for folks that can put their kids in daycare and go out and work. That creates capacity in one of our economies in Minnesota that's already thriving to do better. And so we've got employers that are really struggling to find quality labor. We're really struggling to find those positions to fill so they can continue to make their widgets or whatever it is, the services that they provide. But in that space, in that time, these employers don't even have the time to innovate their widgets because they're busy spending all of their time trying to find the people that will build those widgets. And that's an issue that we've got to address. And I think of this as an economic development issue and something that we've got to drive. Obviously, there are some other concerns that we also have to address as a body. As a greater body, we do need to talk about what it's like and how much it costs to really actually put a kid through child care. And it is as much as going to junior college for parents. We do have to address issues in this time and the space of what it's like to be a provider. And those are issues that we have to address as well, and it has to be done in a timely fashion. And so I appreciate having the ability to have this conversation and to be a part of this conversation today with my two bills, and I look forward to the support that we'll get these dollars where they need to go in communities to, again, build on that idea of community, to build on that idea of the economic development that drives our economy.
So, final word from me. Your bill is still in early childhood finance?
Yes.
I'm trying to find out where this $13 million comes from, mm-hmm. whether it's the Early Childhood Finance Committee or this committee. So any light you can shine on that a little later on with the speaker, and I would appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an issue that we are addressing. We're working on a solution for it, trying to find where that money will go. Yep.
Come from.
Sure. Yeah.
Thank you again. These bills are in the possession of the Early Childhood Committee, so we're not going to act on them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again for coming all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And all of your testifiers.
Yes, thank you.
Members, we have a quorum. So, Representative Eklund, would you care to move the March 1st meeting
in the Mississippi Community Meeting? I'd be happy to move the minutes from March 1st, Mr. Chair.
Members, this is the Jobs and Early Childhood Joint Committee hearing. So are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of the March 1st minutes, please signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, same sign.
Thank you.
Those are passed. Representative Gunter, would you care to move the February 28th meeting minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to.
Thank you. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. We have minutes passed for both. Okay, we have House File 825, Representative KT's Watoon. Did I get it bad or close?
No, pretty good.
All right. We're just hearing this? Okay. Well, we have a couple of bills here. So, which one did you want to take first? Or are you taking them both at the same time?
If that works for you, we can talk. I have the same two testifiers with me to speak to both bills.
Sounds good. Please, do you have any opening comments?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Right. Chair. I'm joining you from the Early Childhood Policy and Finance Division this morning, so I appreciate being here. I missed a little bit of Representative Brand's presentation, but I think after our hearing, our field hearing last week Friday, this is a really important topic that we all discussed together, and I appreciate the opportunity to present the bills in jobs and economic development this morning. I'm a new mother, having jumped into the early childhood and child care realm literally overnight, and as a businesswoman, knowing the difficulties facing startup businesses, especially the disparity in ownership between women-owned organizations and the lower revenue possibility in the child care industry. The programming that I'm presenting today has the potential to lift up female entrepreneurs and to serve children and families, not only in urban areas, but across the state of Minnesota. While the appropriations in HF 825 specifically are currently specific to helping low-income women in urban neighborhoods with the pilot program. It's an innovative approach to cooperative child care. We are discussing the potential capacity to remove that stipulation and the possibility of a pilot in greater Minnesota, with the ultimate goal being to expand statewide. So with that, I will introduce my testifiers from Women Venture, Elaine Wyatt, who is the CEO, and Sarah Pike, who is the director of the Women's Business Center.
Okay.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please identify yourself. Please identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Yes. My name is Sarah Pike. I'm the Women's Business Center Director at Women Venture. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kuzia Watung, thank you for the opportunity to present on House File 825, Women Ventures Cooperative Child Care Business. Women Venture began its work researching the cooperative ownership model in 2016 as we look for a way for low-income women to access the power of small business ownership through different ownership structures. For those not familiar with the worker cooperative model, this model is defined by the workers, or the employees, having equal share of ownership in the business. Worker owners share in the decision-making as well as the profits of the business. When applying this model to low-wage, service-based industries such as childcare or home health care, workers can experience an increase of wages, access to employee benefits such as health care and paid time off, and have a much lower turnover rate than industry standards. We decided to focus in the childcare industry due to the childcare crisis across the state of Minnesota. We believe that this model is one of the strategies that can positively contribute to adding childcare slots throughout the state. We have approached this work using the same principles we bring to all of our work, creating a framework for in-depth training, expert advice, access to capital, and a community of support. We completed the training component of the first pilot this past May 2018, and those co-ops are now in the incubation process. We have two co-op groups in this process. They aim to open at the end of 2019, potentially bringing an additional 110 slots to low-income urban communities. As a result of this program, we supported the launch of La Academia Elsa, a Spanish immersion early learning academy at Plymouth Congregational Church in Minneapolis. A loan from Women Venture made this business possible. When at full capacity, it will support 6 jobs and serve 70 children. My professional background is in cooperative ownership, and the team I'm working with has extensive experience in the childcare industry, including creating profit models for the pod, home-based, and center-based childcare businesses. Our second pilot is launching this week, and we have 5 diverse co-op groups that are interested, with 3 people in each group who have enrolled in the 9-month program. We are applying this extensive knowledge we gained in the first iteration of the program to our second class. Our approach to pilots is incorporating the feedback of client, staff, and volunteers to improve the results. The goal of all of our programs is that they effectively help women to launch and grow and pay them, the owners, a living wage. House File 285 proposes that Women Venture receive funding to continue our work in creating the model for profitable, cooperatively owned child care businesses that can be replicated throughout the state. We anticipate replication to be accomplished through online platforms and mentor and partnership with other economic development agencies. This initial work is already supported by the Kellogg, Northwest Area, and McKnight Foundations. Thank you.
Of course you finish as soon as I pop a donut in my mouth.
Happy Fat Tuesday, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. You're going to stay around. I'm going to, if you've got Ms. Wyatt to testify, we'll ask questions at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Elaine Wyatt, CEO of Women Venture. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kutiza Watun, thank you for the opportunity to present on House File 908, Women Venture Child Care Business Training. For the benefit of those of you who are not familiar with Women Venture, we are a Small Business Administration Women's Business Center. We've been around for 41 years. Our work has always been about helping women improve their lives economically. Over the last 7 years, this work has exclusively been focused on helping women achieve economic self-sufficiency through the power of small business ownership. Our clients range from those who are thinking about starting a business to those who want to scale their business exponentially. Throughout the entrepreneurial pathway, we use a consistent approach: in-depth training, expert advice, access to capital, and an intentional community of support. As a result of this approach, our clients have realized some impressive results. Last year, we served 1,200 women supporting 209 businesses who pay their 1,000 employees an average wage of $20 an hour. Our women business owners surpass their national peers, paying themselves a living wage of $26 an hour. Women Venture did not intentionally focus on childcare business ownership, but instead were led to this work through our loan and training clients, who came to us needing education, capital, and technical assistance. We came to realize that although it is possible to own a profitable childcare business, a complex regulatory environment and narrow margins make it more challenging than some of other business models. We saw the difference between the clients who came to us needing a loan to keep the doors of their childcare businesses open after they had burned through their life savings versus those who went through our in-depth training program and opened their childcare businesses prepared to be profitable from the start. Seeing firsthand the dramatic difference training and preparation on the front end made for these women, we began to seek funding for this important work. House File 908 proposes that Women Venture receive funding to modify its Small Business Essentials program to focus exclusively on home-based, pod-based, and center-based childcare businesses. This modified curriculum would be accessible across the state via open source platforms. The program will be designed so that training can be delivered online as well as through other economic development organizations. This initial work is also supported by the St. Paul Foundation.
Thank you. Are there any questions? It must be just that I've been watching pictures of my grandson trying to figure out how. So now I got questions here on all this child care stuff. So what you have I think you called it a high intense program. What is the individual tuition for that particular program, and does the client pay it? Is there scholarships? Are there sponsorships?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we actually, our cooperative program is free to the clients based on the grant funding that we've received for the urban initiatives that we are launching. For the Small Business Essentials program, it will be a $600 fee. And for many of our clients, low-income clients, they receive scholarships up to 90% off. So it is a very affordable program, and we've never turned anyone away because they cannot pay for our programs.
What is a pod base? What does that mean?
Sure.
The pod base is really based on this idea that within one roof, there are multiple in-home based center child care businesses. So there is an example of this in Detroit Lakes, and I'll use that as an example. The building itself is owned and operated by a nonprofit, and within this building there are, I believe, five separate in-home based child care businesses. The benefit of that, there are a few. The first is when, especially in rural areas where in this particular area, if perhaps one child care business and they decide to leave, you don't lose the entire infrastructure of your child care. You still have these other child care businesses. A benefit of having all of these in-home together under one roof is really this idea of the shared space and potentially other shared resources. So, for example, if all of them have accounting or all of them have marketing or all of them have, you know, regulatory paperwork, how can they come together and either share an accountant or share marketing? So it lifts the burden and the cost of that work on the one child care provider, and they can then share it. We see that this model has a lot of potential in both urban and rural areas.
So it's essentially just it's a co-op with a different name.
Right.
And for either of the testifiers, have you talked with the Initiative Foundation? They apparently have been working on this for many years. I know they've come up with more than one model. Have you shared your model with them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have been in communication with both the Southern Initiative funds as well as the Initiative funds in St. Cloud. In St. Cloud, they're very interested in working with us on a pod model and, you know, are anxious to get started. They have several immigrant women who are interested in this model. And a few things that my colleague I want to add is that one of the strengths of the pod model is that it's much easier to open a home-based than a center-based model. The other thing that the pod offers is sharing of staff. So you can go on vacation. You can move your kids around. The concept is that you register all the kids in all the pods and then you employ floaters, so to speak, in all of them, so that you can easily be flexible as your census goes up and down. So it's very flexible and a lot easier entry point and very profitable for the women. In Detroit Lakes, the women that have been involved have been doing this for 20 years. I call it one of those bright spots in our community that we should really look to create a model that could be replicated, really both urban and rural.
Thank you. Representative Robbins, you had a question?
More a comment, if you will indulge me, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. I have worked with Women Ventures in my previous life and am so impressed with your work. And I also am a co-author on 825. I think this model is really exceptional. First of all, it's a good use of taxpayer dollars, offering a loan rather than a straight grant. It will be repaid, and it will also help these women business owners establish credit, and it also builds wealth because they are owners of the establishment. And so I really support this work, and I urge all members to support the bill. Thank you.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, like you, Representative Robbins, have also carried a bill for Women Ventures. It seems like a model that we can maybe, you heard about the other testimony who wanted $13 million, and here you are asking for $225,000 to start a co-op. One, I'm just wondering, what could you do with $13 million? I thought that.
Happy birthday.
Now those eyes go up.
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Moran, my strategy would most likely make it a loan fund to borrow to women who are trying to start small centers or home-based or pod-based businesses and make it a revolving fund.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. So the one thing we do know, we talk about early learning, we look at the rural community, urban, it's usually women-run businesses. In a huge way, if not all, mostly it is. Is there an interest rate on the loan? What is the interest rate on the loan?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Moran, we do charge interest on our loans, and it ranges from 8.5% to 12% interest, really dependent on the credit history of the client. That may seem high, but many people are really accessing credit online. It can be up to 300%. We see it every day. People take out, cash out their 401ks, load up credit cards. So it really is a very pragmatic approach to delivering capital to women. The difference between a 6% and a 12% rate is not dramatic. And we just really believe in the business structure of having a loan and paying it back.
And Mr. Chair, so I know you've been around for a while doing work on behalf of women's. Are you able to share with us some of the results of your work so we can get maybe an insight of the success of what you're doing with the women businesses?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Moran, I think the greatest success that we've had, particularly in the last 5 years, is really this focus on wage. It's where women business owners are, they just are not competitive with male-owned businesses. And for our clients, on average, and this has been consistent year over year, to be paying themselves a living wage of $26 an hour, that's been really consistent year over year, and now we're really seeing them move what they're paying their employees as well. You know, over the last few years, that has continued to grow. This year is at $20 an hour on average that they're paying their employees. And I what I see with women-owned businesses is that they really understand their connection to the community and to their employees, and I think we see that in the wages that they're paying their employees.
In one closing statement, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moran.
So I'm just thinking, you know, we heard this morning about the lack of providers in greater Minnesota and the need to for infrastructure. And that just sounds like a good model that can be utilized and replicated in rural Minnesota. So just want to just maybe suggest that, you know, help them out up there and see if we can get some more providers where they're not feeling alone by themselves or trying to go through paperwork by themselves or grow their business by themselves. Having that type of support is usually needed. And it's, in my mind, it's always great to have that support coming from other women who kind of like know the business practice.
Was that a question or a comment?
No, that was the comment.
All right. Thank you, Representative Moran. Representative Dabney, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and of course I'll take the liberty to start with the comment and then we'll get to the question.
Oh. We got about 15 minutes.
All right, I'll try to be brief, although that's not my strong suit, as you know. Very positive on this bill, because what I struck with this morning is how our state's lack of investment in child care and our telling moms in particular, but parents, that it's your problem, you solve it, has restrained job growth in Minnesota. The latest budget forecast was very clear from the state economist. One of the biggest challenge for economic growth is employers unable to find qualified employees, and maybe most particularly in greater Minnesota. And what we hear from greater Minnesota is businesses can't expand because they can't find the workers because the workers can't find the child care. So our lack of investment has really restrained economic growth for everybody and opportunity for everybody, including these 99% women run businesses who often come there for the love of the children. But a variation of what I said Friday at our hearing in St. Cloud, you can't eat love, you can't pay the mortgage with love, you can't pay your medical bills or buy food with love. You actually need money. One of the things that Minnesota does well is co-ops. And I think you're picking up that concept is potentially powerful. Can you talk about how that works with developing the business skills of these women? Because the love is great. A lot of these in-home centers start with a mom who wants to stay home with her own and then picks up some neighborhood kids but doesn't necessarily have the business chops. So can you talk about how you support them in developing their business skills?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our training program, specifically I'll first talk about the cooperative program, really has three components to it. It has a business component, and we really focus in on the business of running a child care. What are the profitability pressure points to running a child care? Are you going to have enough seats to actually pay for your expenses? What are you charging? Are those seats actually full? Right? If you have 75% capacity, you might actually not be able to reach your revenue goals. So we really focus on the business from a financial standpoint. Just like our Small Business Essentials class, we cover really from idea conception through launch of all the different business concepts. So market research is the area that you want to open your business, have the demand. We look at what kind of marketing you're going to do. We're looking at operations, at staffing, and then really thinking about that profitability model and the financials. So what does your cash flow look like? And really doing an in-depth understanding of what your finances are and understanding them, right? We understand these women aren't probably going into business to be the accountants in their business, but really understanding what are your finances
telling you about your business. So we really go into depth about that. And that is really true for our solo entrepreneur course as well. As it relates to the cooperative, we really do have a good chunk of information within the cooperative program about what does cooperative governance look like. This isn't one person who's the boss. It's really democratic decision making. It can be difficult. So we look at structure. We look at process. We look at how the members can have voice and how you can make efficient decision making so you don't get hung up in the decisions. So it really it takes a look at that infrastructure and process of decision making. We practice that throughout the entire class. So what's your mission statement? Let's as a collective group within your co-op really learn to how you're going to articulate that together. So we focus both on the business side as well as what does it take to run the cooperative. Following with all of our clients and loan clients, they have technical assistance following a loan. And one of the things we're really looking at is how do we support them, not only on the business side, but on that cooperative governance side. It can be difficult. That's why, honestly, that this program is 9 months, so that they can develop the trust, they can develop that understanding of how you operate a business together. We feel that that is just as important as that business aspect.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for that. It just also leads me to the question of what is the value of building entrepreneurial skills in these urban communities? Often in communities where women in particular, but many members of the community have not had the opportunity to build those sorts of skills. And what's the spinoff value of that? Because I think once you start to learn some of these skills, they're applicable outside of childcare. They're applicable across innovative ideas and opportunities. So
you want to be careful with that because it also it's applicable to political campaigns.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Warning.
Are there any other questions? I see none. Oh, John, Representative Koznick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and more of a procedural kind of question. These two bills are kind of on informational hearings only, and I believe they had already had a hearing in the Early Child Care Committee. Is that correct?
Yes.
So, and I know I got here late. The traffic was typical, but so I think you might have sort of kind of mentioned it, but just if you wouldn't mind clarifying why they're on informational instead of
why they're not just staying in the Early Childhood Committee.
Well, why aren't we taking formal action on them?
I'm trying not to have to pay for them. I've supported all four of these particular bills, but I'm still kind of questioning whose budget it comes out of. So I figured if it by possibility come to our budget, then we should know about it.
Okay. That's a good answer. I appreciate it.
Representative Gunther. And then we have one bill left.
Little advice. HHS has got a lot more money than we do.
Do you have any closing comments?
I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. I know you have one more bill, and I can return to early childhood. But I just, again, echoing back to our field hearing in St. Cloud last week, one of the things that stuck with me was the short video that we were able to watch, and one of the taglines in there was that in this current child care crisis that we have, parents can't afford to pay, providers can't afford to stay in child care, and public investment is the way. So I appreciate your support for these bills.
Well, thank you. Thank you, and thank you to the testifiers. Appreciate your time and your energy today and the work that you do. Thank you. Representative Richardson. Good morning. We have about 13 minutes left to the committee. We took a little longer on some of the bills than I thought, so I apologize. But just giving you fair warning, at 9:30, they're going to kick us out of here. And We are laying your bill over, so there's no need to make a motion other than lay the bill over. And please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So House File 1594 would appropriate $700,000 in fiscal year 20 and 21 from the Workforce Development Fund to DEED for a grant to the YWCA of Minneapolis to provide job training, career counseling, and job placement assistance to individuals facing economic challenges interested in pursuing careers in early childhood education. The program will help them secure a child development associate credential, and currently this program is being funded at $500,000 per year. This is a foundational post-secondary credential that qualifies participants to enter the field as early childhood teachers. This training opportunity provides a pathway to economic independence. The program takes about 9 months to complete, and participants receive individualized support and case management throughout the process. Since the program began in October of 2016, 250 participants have gone through the program, and 92% of those participants are employed in the early childhood education field. 90% of the participants have been hired while taking the course, and currently there are 79 participants that are anticipated to graduate in June of this year. Increased funding would allow the program to expand the service delivery area and increase participation to an estimated 200 participants. I have a few testifiers here today that are willing to share some information about the program, and the first testifier is Stephanie Thomas from the YWCA.
Actually, I'll speak because I'm
Paula. Okay. Paula Landis will speak for Stephanie.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself for the tape.
What's that?
Please identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. I'm Paula Landis. I'm with the YWCA of Minneapolis, and I'm the program instructor, and I work with Stephanie Thomas, who's our vice president of the Early Childhood Education Department at the YWCA. So thank you so much for covering the highlights of the program. The one thing that I wish to add is that the field of early childhood, as you all are well aware by now, if you weren't already, is in crisis. We fail to attract and retain teachers to meet the needs that children and families have in our communities, not just in urban, but also in greater Minnesota. What our program is highly excelling at is closing the gap between culturally and linguistically diverse teachers and white teachers. So while we focus on our entrance requirements are economics, what we also see in our program demographics is 24% immigrant participants, and about 80% of people that identify as of color in our graduates. So what we're doing is closing that education gap, and I'd be happy to answer questions further, but I know we're short on time, so I'd like to turn it over to Sofia and Lisa.
Please come to the table and identify yourself.
My name is Lisa Bandley. I'm a participant in the YWCA program. Before this program, the thought of a secondary education was next to impossible. But now I was recently hired at the Abbott YWCA Center, and I have a career that I love. I have support from great teachers and great classmates, and I can take my education further until I have my own center, and that just fills me with joy. And I'm so grateful for this program. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll stick around in case there's a question. Good morning. Please identify yourself for the tape.
My name is Sophia Aden. I work with kids for almost 11 years now, and when I started as a teacher aide and just helping out, and I've been doing that long because there's a little bit of the language. I'm also sorry, I never see this many faces looking at me, so a little bit nervous.
Could you please talk closer to the mic, though, please?
So I'm kind of a little bit nervous, so if this, all right. This program helped me a lot and teach me a lot. I work New Horizon, and I've been working for them for a long time. And it helped me not only being there for the kids, but also myself how to be a better teacher and teach them, like, understanding more than what I thought I know already. And because even though I worked that long with kids and I take training classes, like every year we have to have 40 hours in service going so many classes. But when I went this program, I learned a lot. And that helps me to be stronger. And when I go to my classroom and my babies, I help them to learn so much. And other things I learned was, first I got my CDA, which is yay. And I get paid more, which is helps me and my family, which is, oh, before I was working two jobs. Now I can work one job and my other time go to school and more get my education better as well. And I learned how childhood is so important for the little kids. Like, we're really there for them and just do with them. But when you go, this class is teaching me when they this little and this long, like how important for them to grow, how we can change in them and the future when they're even little. I did not know that. And also I did not know their childhood, little childhood, even my own, I forget. I lived that one back home. Nobody ever talk about it. And when I go this program, I come a lot of stuff I didn't even forget when I'm back home and learning. And I get to know myself, to get to know the kids. And this program helped me so much. I cannot thank enough the teachers and the people. So I wish I could say what I'm super nervous. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the testifiers or the bill author? Representative Moran.
I just wanted to make a statement because what the testifier just reminded me of, you know, we've been talking a lot about economics and communities being able to thrive and providers. But at the bottom of the importance of having kids in a quality daycare center is that they are able to enter kindergarten ready and prepared, that they are reading by third grade, that if that is happening, we know that they are more apt to be more educated, they're ready and prepared for the workforce, and it won't be a burden on the state. So I just want to keep us in mind that one of the reasons that we say we want to invest in early childhood education is because it prepares kids to go into kindergarten ready, reading by third grade. And we know nowadays you got to be reading probably in kindergarten, so definitely first grade.
Otherwise,
you have to have some of those skill sets. And that is what early learning does, and that's why it's important, and that's why we need to invest in it. And so to the testifiers, just thank you for that reminder about why it's so important for us here at the state level to invest in early childhood education.
Thank you. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, how many hours are required for the CDA, and how many hours is the individual required to work in a setting? At the same time, we haven't talked much about the social-emotional development issues and the requirement for continued education for childcare centers and individuals, including the initial requirement for the number of hours they're required to have a license. I've asked several questions, but you can take it there.
Good. Catch me if I start to go astray.
I'm going to, before you start to answer, we're kind of focused on more the money, so the social and emotional piece probably is not needed in this committee.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. The hourly requirements for a teacher to become a teacher, is that your question, by licensing standards?
Correct.
So there's a variety of entry points that people can make to the different levels of teachers. There's aides, assistants, and teachers. What our program does is provide, it requires 500 hours of work inside a classroom in addition to our training program, right? So there's several pieces. The classroom time that Ms. Aiden was referring to is 140 hours of work, and that covers 8 content areas that are part of the national requirements to be qualified to take the test. In addition to doing that, they're working 500 hours in a parent-aware or NACE-rated center where they get the opportunity to enact the training that I'm giving them in the classroom. And that together allows them at a minimum to enter at an assistant teacher level. Depending on the hours they've already had prior to our program, they might go in at a teacher level. Does that answer your question?
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I have one question myself. You spoke to the idea of wanting to expand your program. Expand where? More in downtown Minneapolis? More in Timbuktu? Yep.
Thank you. I don't think we would go that far. We are working in Hennepin County, Anoka, Ramsey, and Washington County right now. At one point, we were running five classes a week plus every other Saturday. We would like to continue that model within our realm. If we were able to expand greater, that would require a different set of financing and programming strategies, one that we're not here to discuss today, but our model is absolutely scalable.
Thank you. Representative Cagle?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And where do these classes take place? I know through some of my work, I worked with students at the Hub Center. Do you have partnerships throughout the community?
We do. Right now, thank you for the question. We are at the Community Action Program in St. Paul. We've held classes at Anoka, Washington County Head Start. And then we also hold classes in our office spaces at the downtown YWCA. So we're flexible to travel. So it depends on where we are.
Any other questions, members? Seeing none, any final comments, Representative Richardson?
No, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to ask for support. Thank you.
Ms. Data would like to reiterate one important point that she failed to make. Ready? Come on, she's got to say it.
One thing I wanted to add, we got so many diversity kids, but we don't have so many diversity teachers. And there's so many daycares have a caregiver work there, but they don't really go to classes or educated. And I think a lot of the community need that. Those teachers and those kids do need to be educated, and this program will help a lot. And I wanted you guys to know that. And also, this is so flexible, so anybody can go. They make it easier. Anybody can go there. I work, and I go to, and I have kids, and I go to Saturdays, so this helps everybody. But
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Seeing none, no other questions, and I will renew my motion to lay this bill over for possible inclusion on the jobs omnibus bill. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any comments or concerns before I I do have one thing. I had made some comments about what we were going to do with the bonding bills. I heard from one, no others, so what we'll be doing is moving all of the bonding bills, unless some of them stick out pretty badly. We've gotten instructions to weed them a little bit, but I'm not going to do that because I don't think, unless I hear all of them, it's not fair. But I think I have one that asks for $80 million for some particular project that's probably not moving forward because of my budget and the bonding bill's budget. So it'll still be alive for next year, but I'm going to move them all on Thursday, by memo to the capital investment and let Chair Murphy deal with them. Having seen none, we are adjourned. Thank you.